fitness, nutrition, sleep, longevity, performance, fat loss, and all the keys to a life of health, happiness, and success. I'm Jed Zimmer, your host, and welcome to The Health Project. Welcome back, guys. We've got episode 28 tonight of The Health Project, so it's absolutely awesome to be back in the swing of things. I do apologize if there is a bit of background noise. I'm currently doing this recording up at my office at the gym, so a few weights are being thrown around, so I do apologize, but hopefully it's not too bad. But nonetheless, awesome episode tonight, which I'm pretty excited about. We've got Dr. Jeff Lekhovan jumping on, who very well known in the integrative and sports medicine industry, working as a naturopathic chiropractor, as well as very established in the acupuncture field. So, you know, he covers a lot tonight. He's the founder of Eat, Move, and Perform Better. And as you pretty much can tell, he knows a lot about all things integrative and holistic medicine. So I've learned a lot from him, in particular when it comes to sports injuries, weight management, some recovery methods, but most notably all things metabolism and metabolic flexibility, which is a really good topic that we're going to touch on tonight. But before jumping into that, I'm going to cover a few of the supplements that I'm currently taking at the moment, because I chucked up a post last night, which I end up getting rid of quite quickly because I did get a few questions straight away, and I thought it would be only fitting and more appropriate to cover a few of these supplements in depth on tonight's episode. So before jumping into that, I think it is important to mention that, you know, with supplements, you do have to, find what works best for you. Not all supplements are going to be suitable for each person. And I think with a lot of things, it's great to cycle. So a lot of these supplements that I'm about to mention, I'm not necessarily taking these all year round. So I am cycling with quite a few of them. All right. So to kick things off, and a bit of a shameless plug, obviously being the founder of Health Project Supplements, you can, all these supplements that I do mention, I am quite picky being the founder with, you know, the quality of supplements I chose to work with, and, you know, I didn't want to work with any of the industries that weren't of the utmost quality. So I was very picky, and that's the reason why I do take a lot of these supplements myself. So the very first one I take is it's called Total Defense, which is pretty much a general multivitamin by ATP Labs. Just like most multivitamins, they cover a lot of your bases, so they fill in any gaps that you might not hit with your diet. And 9 times out of 10, I don't think a lot of people need to have a multivitamin if they are, you know, sticking to a reasonable diet and they are getting most of their nutrients in through the food they're consuming. But you know, I just feel through me, especially because I cycle with a few different diets. I go through paleo, I experiment with ketogenic diets. I just feel like this is, you know, it's benefited my health a lot. It's pretty much got everything in it, from L-glutamine, which is another thing I'm about to touch on, to zinc, magnesium, and the list goes on. So I currently take that at the moment. I take that, I take 2 capsules in the morning and then 2 capsules in the evening. The second one, which I've got in front of me, is a product also by ATP Labs, called Gluco Control. Again, I've spoken a little bit about this both on the podcast and social media previously, but this is one of my favorite supplements for fat loss. So a lot of people, when they think of fat loss, they think of their Oxy Shreds, and all those, you might think of your pre-workouts and thermos, but Gluco Control is, I reckon it's your bang for your buck. It's a digestive aid health as well, and that's where it sort of started. So the company ATP Labs actually designed this for digestive benefits, but since doing a bit of research, especially when it came to type 2 diabetics, they noticed a significant increase in insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is obviously, when it comes to health, longevity, performance, it's one of the biggest indicators, and especially when it comes to fat gain, a lot of those high carb diets or constant spikes in insulin is what actually leads to a lot of fat gain in particular. So Gluco Control is a great option for anyone looking to lose body fat, especially if you're following a high carbohydrate diet. So for me personally, I have 2 capsules of this with my most carb dominant meal of the day, which is generally of an evening, as I've touched on, because evening carbohydrates are great for serotonin levels, tyrosine, which can help with sleep relaxation. So I'll take 2 capsules of this in the evening, as well as another 2 if I fit in some carbs throughout the day, or just a general big meal. So sometimes I might have a huge lunch if it's applicable. And because obviously this being a digestive aid, I'll take another 2 of that, and that's only going to speed digestion up. So Total defense, gluco control. On top of this, I love Quadramag by Strength Sensei. Again, I'm pretty picky with the quality, and this is one of the highest quality magnesium supplements that I've found out there on the market. Another great option is the Gabamag by Trilogy. Magnesium is, you know, it's well known that magnesium is one of the most bioavailable nutrients in the body. It's involved in hundreds of chemical reactions, and especially when it comes to athletes and those people who exercise quite a lot, what you often find is they're pretty depleted in their magnesium levels, and this can inhibit their sleep, especially when it comes to deep sleep. It can inhibit their recovery, muscle gain. It's going to lead to inflammation in the body, and if you're inflamed, if you've got inflammation in the body, you're not going to be able to lose weight. So pretty much a lot of things come back down to how well your body's functioning. Magnesium is one of my go-tos that I think just about everyone should supplement with, whether they are trying to improve their sleep recovery or some of those things I just touched on. Again, it's Quadramag by Strength Sensei. It's one of my favorites because it's got a few different forms of magnesium. So there is a few different forms. So for instance, at the back here that I'm currently reading, it's got magnesium glycinate, magnesium taurate, magnesium orotate. Now, a few of these, there's some different functions. So for instance, some of these are involved in the liver function, so they help with detoxification. Some of them help. So magnesium glycinate in particular is good for relaxation, which is awesome for sleep. So that covers all bases, and that's the reason I take that one. I take that of an evening with a meal. So magnesium is best absorbed with a meal. That leads on very nicely to the next product that I also love, which is also by Strength Sensei, which is Omega Drive, which is fish oil. Again, very high quality fish oil. So I think when it comes to fish oil in particular, you got to be real picky because some of those fish oils out there in the market, you pretty much pay for what you get. So I think some of them, those cheap ones that you can pick up at a grocery store or supermarket, I think they do your body more harm than good, if ever anything. So you got to look for a high quality fish oil supplement that's not rancid. And one thing I always look out for is the ratio between EPA and DHA. And this particular supplement is a 2-to-1 ratio of EPA to DHA, which is about the ratio that you got to strive for. So a lot of the ratios you see on the fish oils that you can find at a supermarket are the complete opposite. So the DHA is actually a lot higher than the EPA, which is going to cause inflammation, where the whole idea of fish oil is actually to reduce inflammation. So it's a no-brainer for me to look for a high-quality fish oil supplement. I take that of an evening with a meal. So same thing, just like the magnesium, fish oil is best absorbed with a meal, in particular a high-fat meal. So if you're going to, it's great if you're following a ketogenic diet, but anytime you have a high-fat meal, that's the best time, and that's the best time you're going to absorb the fish oil. So two steps with that, with a meal, high-fat meal, and the other thing is try and refrigerate it. Again, that's just going to help with the absorption. So that's the basis. On top of this, I love creatine, which I've spoken about. I take 5 grams every single day of the year. There's no need to cycle with it. I break those two servings up, I break those the 5 grams into two different servings. So two to three grams pre-workout, 2 to 3 grams post-workout. The reason I do this is because your body can only absorb 2 to 3 grams at once. So for cost-effective reasons, I do that, because if you're going to have the 5 grams at once, your body's not going to absorb it all. I take L-glutamine. L-glutamine's incredible for your gut health. It's incredible for your immune function. So anytime, studies have actually shown any time that participants are starting to feel unwell with cold and flu symptoms, supplementing with L-glutamine as well as vitamin C. So the particular study that I'm talking about was 20 to 30 grams, which is quite high, of L-glutamine per day, reduce the severity of the common cold. So I take that. It's also great for, I've already touched on digestive health, but it's also great for muscle function, so recovery as well. For me, how do I supplement both of them? So the creatine is pre and post workout. L-glutamine, 5 grams first thing in the morning on an empty stomach, as well as 5 grams intra workout. So I like to get that in intra workout to get into the muscle cells, and then as well as in the evening, as it can also help with sleep. So with the magnesium and the L-glutamine, that's a bang for your buck. Few other little things. I'm a bit of a supplement guru, not guru. That's the complete wrong word that I was after, but geek, I guess you could say. I look into my supplements quite a lot. I'm quite picky. I love a good collagen supplement. Collagen's great for joint health as well as skin health. I think anyone looking to improve their body composition is great, but why do that at the expense of your skin health and all that? So I love looking after proper skin and skin microbiome. So collagen's great for that. I love the True Protein one there. I simply have that with some hot water and it comes up like a hot chocolate drink. I'll take that anytime throughout the day. And I also cycle with either a whey protein or a vegan protein, which I purely have just post-workout. The reason I cycle is because your body can become intolerant to both vegan proteins and whey protein. So I like to cycle between the two of them. So that simply looks like I might go through one bag of, you know, WPI-90 and then simply rotate with that with a vegan protein and just cycle between the two. So that's sort of where it's at with me at the moment. I'm trying to cover. Well, one last other thing that I'm taking is also carnitine, which is another great fat loss supplement carnitine helps metabolize fatty acids and converts fat to energy pretty much. So it's a great option pre-workout as well as also with any other high-carb dominant meal. So if you have the carnitine with glucose control when it comes to fat loss, you got your bang for your buck because carnitine in a lot of studies is now showing that can actually help very similar to glucose control with insulin sensitivity. So if you supplement with carnitine, best time to do that is when you're going to convert any, when you're going to utilize energy, sorry, so pre-workout as well as a high carbohydrate meal. So that's about it for me. As you can see, I'm trying to cover all bases. So hormone health, fat loss, muscle gain, recovery, sleep, pretty much everything. And I try to be pretty picky with it all. So enough for me. Really good episode 9, episode 28 with Dr. Jeffrey Coven. Shoot us some feedback if you enjoy it. And we'll keep this journey going, guys. It's been... All right. Well, let's get into it, Jeff. First thing I want to touch on is metabolism and, you know, why is it so important to, you know, be metabolic flexible and what steps do you take to increase metabolism?
All right. So, metabolic flexibility, as you know, is a term that describes one's ability to use different substrates, primarily carbohydrates and fats, under different circumstances. So, for example, if we're just sitting here at rest, ideally we'd be burning fat. And when we're doing more exercise, increasing the intensity, then we're going to burn more carbohydrates or a mixture of the two. Mm. So from a performance and a health perspective, it's good to be able to use these substrates under the appropriate condition in an optimal fashion.
Right. Mm. And can we, just on that, how do we train our body to be able to do this?
So, I mean, to become metabolically flexible, you probably want to, achieve ideal health, ideal body weight. So a lot of times we have people at extremes where people are, for example, I mean, let's take two extremes, okay? One extreme would be someone who's got type 2 diabetes or metabolic syndrome.
Yeah.
Another extreme would be somebody who is on a very strict keto diet.
Mm.
And so under these extreme circumstances, these people are probably not good at being able to utilize substrates. And again, when I say substrates, I'm talking about the main fuels for activity, carbohydrates and fats.
Mm.
Under a certain circumstance. So for example, people who are on keto and are keto adapted, they downregulate an enzyme called pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is an important enzyme in the Krebs cycle that enables one to efficiently use carbohydrates.
Mm.
And if you look at some of the work with Louise Burke, who is part of the International Olympic Committee and actually in your neck of the woods, she writes about this in several studies where people lose this ability to selectively use carbohydrates under the appropriate situations or scenarios.
Mm.
On the other side of the coin, you'd have somebody who has type 2 diabetes and they have a difficulty with insulin sensitivity and using carbohydrates appropriately.
Mm. So when it comes to diet and your philosophy, is it going to be very individualized regarding specific, as you said, if it's type 2 diabetes, you might look towards a more ketogenic diet. Is this the approach that you follow? It is very individualized.
I think it's very, yeah, for sure it's individualized. So I'll do lab testing and, take a history, look at a person's diet, look at, the aspects. I call it the speed phenomenon. So I look at their sleep habits, their psychological stress, environmental factors, the type of exercise that they do, and their diet. see where they're deficient and how I can support those aspects in order to help them become more flexible.
Incredible. In terms of I'm intrigued to ask, in terms of athletic performance, you know, there's views out there, whether it's, it might be for anaerobic athletes that they need carbohydrates, and some studies have obviously shown that the ketogenic diet can support aerobic athletes. As a bassist, do you think there's any, are you of the belief of both of these opinions?
So, I mean, I believe in the science, right? What does the evidence show? And I've kind of been of the stance, based on the position stands of the International Olympic Committee and the International Society of Sports Nutrition, that while a ketogenic diet may support low intensity or longer duration types of activities, that when it comes to performance, carbohydrates are king.
Right.
I think that the evidence is in favor of that at this point.
And when it comes to the ketogenic diet, and intermittent fasting is obviously a very popular topic, how does this affect the metabolism?
So let's back up and talk about metabolism. Okay.
Sounds good.
So when you look at metabolism, you can look at it as a pie. Okay. And if you were to divide that pie into thirds, 2/3 are about 60% of your metabolism is based on your resting metabolic rate.
Right.
And resting metabolic rate is determined by your age, your height, your weight, your gender, your lean body mass to a certain extent, and any disease process that you might have, such as hypothyroidism. And then 30% has to do with your activity, energy expenditure. So we're talking about formal exercise and then something called NEAT, which is non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And that comes into play with what we do formally with exercise and then what you do with things like walking or fidgeting, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the 10% has to do with a thermic effect of food. So what foods, you know, primarily protein and fiber, are those foods that have an energy cost in their breakdown. So when it comes to slowing, so, you know, let's go back. What's your question about metabolism?
I was just touching on, let's go into some biohacks. So you're touching on thermogenesis, and let's go into, you know, the root of how we can actually biohack it, whether it is, you know, cold thermogenesis, and using exercise and things like this.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I wrote an article a while back called how to biohack your metabolism. I kind of fell back to that model, that speed model. So one way is to get optimal sleep. You know, if you're not getting a good amount of sleep, that's going to adversely affect hormones like your fight or flight hormones, like cortisol, your leptin, your ghrelin. And so that's going to affect how full you feel after eating, your and cravings.
Just with sleep, what measures are you taking? Is it as, you know, simple as what we've all commonly heard about getting off your phone, blocking as much blue light as possible? Do you have any sort of measures you like to put in place?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to have electronics in the room, not have computers in the room, dial down a couple hours before bed, maybe do some meditation, or I like to foam roll and stretch, just kind of get my body ready to relax and get into more parasympathetic state.
Right. So that's the sleep side of things, and then moving on from there.
Okay, so psychological stress. So what are some things that you can do to modulate stress? Well, of course, again, that goes down to like visual imagery or meditation or going for a walk or having some quality time with your partner. You know, there are also like herbs you can use, for example. Like, I'm a big fan of ashwagandha to help modulate the stress response. So from an environmental perspective, we're looking at a number of things. So one thing could be common endocrine disrupting chemicals or obesogens that are found in a lot of these self-care products that we use that have artificial chemicals, also in the foods that we use.
What's your advice when it comes to, you know, avoiding as much of these as possible?
Well, first of all, get a good resource. So like the Environmental Working Group has a talks about, for example, the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 when it comes to organic or non-organic foods. Mm. It's got an app called Skin Deep that where you can look at various products to see which ones have a higher concentration of some of these chemicals that are that we're exposed to. Mm. So using things very simple. So, you know, here when you go to like some of the local co-ops, you can get a lot of products that are free and clear and don't and have minimal types of chemicals in them.
Right.
Is
it in terms of the elimination, you obviously, you know, removing some of these toxins from the body, is there things like sauna or exercise? How do you like to remove these toxins from the body?
So like a lot of times people come to me as a naturopathic physician and say, I want to do a detox. And I think that term has been kind of blown out of proportion and kind of taken on a bit of a metaphysical, if you will, or a tone where people are trying to sell you something to take, right? Mm. So basically, let's look at detox. So your body detoxes through respiration, perspiration, elimination through your stools and through your kidneys and by your liver.
Right.
So if you were looking at a detox, so to speak, I try to evaluate with my patients which of those areas of elimination are clogged or static or not working as well. So somebody says, well, you know, I'm on several medications. Well, maybe they need a little help with their liver. Somebody says they're constipated, then I'm going to work with their bowels and their GI. Right. Somebody says, well, I don't drink a whole lot of water, then we're going to increase their water to help with urination. Mm. Or somebody doesn't exercise, then I'll help them to exercise for perspiration and respiration.
Right. Again, so it's very individualized too.
Yeah.
Mm. And with the diet standpoint, you know, we've already touched on it, that it's going to be very individualized and it's going to differ for each, you know, each person regarding on what their goal, you know, where their health is. As a general rule, you know, do you have a basis to your diet philosophy?
So, I mean, again, my philosophy is I use a model that I think it came from somebody in your neck of the woods. He's a bodybuilder and a very well-known nutritionist.
Yep.
His name's escaped me right now. It'll come to me. But
right.
Say again?
I was just going to say, if you do remember, just
jump in. But so basically he had a pyramid, and the pyramid, the foundation of the pyramid is energy. Mm. So basically energy meaning calories, using calories or energy intake to match your needs and your goals, right? So I always try and get a needs analysis on somebody. What are their needs? What are their goals? Mm. Are they trying to lose weight, gain weight? Is it wellness? Are they type 2 diabetes? Whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And then match the overall calories to what's going to be in their best interest for their goals.
Mm. When it comes to, yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, so and where do you get calories from? Through your three major macronutrients. So proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. So I like to look at or use the recommendations by the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, and the ISSN regarding these nutrients. And I think with protein, aiming for somewhere between 1.5 and 2 grams per kilogram body weight of high-quality protein. And then with carbohydrates, matching the carbohydrates to somebody's activity level. So we call it periodizing your carbohydrate needs. So if somebody's kind of sitting around doing nothing, then they don't need as many carbohydrates. If they're playing a skilled sport, then they need a little bit more. If they're a marathon runner and or having, you know, workouts twice a day, you know, you can use up to around 12 grams per kilogram body weight. So matching the carbohydrates to the activity needs.
Would you say in terms of a goal orientation, say if it is fat loss, if fat loss is the goal, is, you know, a reduction of carbs something you would look towards?
So we're going to look at the total calorie intake, and let's say you know, we're talking about fat loss, not just weight loss, right? Yeah. So the ideal scenario, I believe, the evidence points to resistance training in a hypocaloric state and with a high protein diet. So upwards towards 2 grams per kilogram body weight, even higher under certain circumstances or depending on the individual. Right. And then, again, periodizing the carbohydrates to support your activity. So like if somebody's strength training, maybe they can get away with 3 grams per kg body weight for the carbohydrate intake.
Right. And in terms of carbs, sorry, go on.
No, I think certainly a lot of physique athletes have used lower carbohydrate diets to, you know, to help with body fat loss when they're in there getting towards their peak week and stuff. But I think that a lot of times, at some point, you're going to get this adaptive thermogenesis. So you're going to have to manipulate things in order to get over that hump.
In terms of these athletes, you know, who have played around with their diet, they might, you know, calorie restrict themselves. They might try intermittent fasting. They might reduce carbs for, as you say, it might be bodybuilding comps. Does this have a long-term effect on their overall metabolism?
Yeah, I mean, you can damage your metabolism. I think if you are too extreme for long periods of time, and you know, again, you want to be flexible, right? And if you look at the ISSN, that's the International Society of Sports Nutrition, position stand on weight loss, they, you know, they talk about like the different diets and the consensus across the board. And I know it's a big argument that a lot of people who are, you know, very pro keto, but the consensus is that, you know, it's calories.
Yeah,
and certainly, I mean, one would be foolish to say that 100 calories of sugar-based cereal behaves the same way as a 100 calories of a piece of steak. You know, that's where the thermic effect of food comes into play, and why higher protein diets, I think, are the key rather than so much lower carbohydrate diets.
Looking at things from, I guess, outside of the nutrition side of things, from a biohacking standpoint, do things like cold thermogenesis, does this have an effect on, you know, one, metabolism? I've just interviewed Ben Greenfield, who he likes to use cold thermogenesis to sort of, he does it first thing in the morning, and he says that this sort of stops his insulin spike throughout the day. Cold thermogenesis, it could be sauna. Do these biohacks have an effect?
Yeah, I think that like anything that you can do to increase your BAT or your brown adipose tissue can be helpful. And I think that, you know, that's part of this NEAT, this non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So I'm a big fan of, you know, wearing less clothes to bed, at least trying to convince my wife to do so. you know, or like wearing less clothes around the house, you know, doing things, I think that can be very helpful.
Do you experiment with, you know, cold showers, ice baths, anything like that?
I'm like our friend Mike Mutzel does, not quite to that extreme, but you know, I will end with a cold shower, and I do like to try and wear less clothes when I'm outside or walking around the house.
Right. And from a supplementation standpoint, again, I know it's going to be very individual to specific needs, but from an overall view, you know, is there common sort of supplementation needs that you think a lot of people can benefit from, whether it's, you know, fish oil, zinc, just stuff that you've found that majority of the population can benefit from?
So, okay, so let's get back to that pyramid for a second, okay?
Yep.
So we were talking about energy intake, then the macronutrients, and then micronutrients, right? So that's the next part of this pyramid. And we're getting smaller. These parts of the pyramid are getting smaller and smaller as we get to the top, right?
Yeah.
So micronutrients, we're talking about vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients from plants, micronutrients from mushrooms, zoonutrients from meat. These all have specific anti-inflammatory or health-related properties, okay? On top of that comes nutrient timing. And we know that nutrient timing, whether you're doing intermittent fasting or doing something called train low, where you are training in a carbohydrate-depleted state in order to create different molecular signals in the body to create an adaptation. So if you're an aerobic athlete and you train low, you might have more mitochondria through this production of PGC1 alpha, which will help once you start to train in a carbohydrate repleted state, you'll have more mitochondria and be able to perform better. So that would be more, you know, looking at timing. And at the very top of the pyramid, occupying a very small space, is the supplements. I think from a performance perspective, again, maybe 3% effect from a supplement, and that would only be in people who have mastered everything on the lower part of the pyramid. So, for example, if somebody is in an energy depleted state, or they're not getting enough protein, you can't out supplement a poor diet or a poor training strategy.
Absolutely.
When it comes to supplements, you know, again, it's very individualized, but you know, for example, if somebody is a marathon runner, I might recommend a carbohydrate supplement. If somebody is a bodybuilder, I'll recommend whey protein powder or some kind of protein supplement.
Going back to what you touched on about endurance athletes, the practice of, you know, training in a low carbohydrate state, is this something that you would have them do on a regular basis, or it's, you know, just to sort of shock the system every once in a while?
Yeah, so that's something you would do every once in a while in order to create these adaptations. And, you know, there are some good articles out there in peer-reviewed our journals on this idea of training low, competing high. And, you know, the issue is it has to be taken in context, right? You have a lot of tools in the toolbox, but, you know, for somebody like a bodybuilder, yeah, or a physique athlete that's trying to increase their strength, training a low carbohydrate state is really not going to be the ideal scenario, because a strength athlete, it doesn't matter if they have more mitochondria. It matters if they have more mTOR in order to, you know, it matters if you stimulate the production of mTOR through leucine in order to get that trigger for muscle protein synthesis. Right. And then you want to, you know, get the protein and the calories on top of that. So it just depends on the person's goals. And a lot of times these can be antagonistic, right? So somebody who is on one side of that adaptation and trying to get the more mitochondria, but at the same time doing strength training, there might be some interference effect that can...
Can you find, you know, a healthy balance and a middle ground with it all?
Well, it depends on your goals, right? So that, you know, you have this phenomenon called the... you know, your body adapts to the training stimulus and to, you know, the specific adaptations of imposed demands, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to be like a CrossFit athlete, for example, and have a little bit of everything, you know, you might be really good at the CrossFit games, but when it comes to like, and that might be your goal, which is fine, right? But if your goal is to complete a marathon or a triathlon in the fastest amount of time, then I would say you need to gear your training and your nutrition in order to meet those goals. And it's going to be different than strength athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it all comes back to specific goals that each client is looking for.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of an exercise standpoint, you know, let's talk about endurance for a second. There's a debate about, you know, whether they should be doing long cardio, or you can get every bit of beneficial results from short bursts of high intensity, and, you know, bouts of exercise throughout the day. What's your view towards, you know, increasing endurance without putting too much stress on the body?
Well, I think that's definitely a big stress. And I know a lot of athletes, endurance athletes, that have gone through that general adaptation syndrome where you get to this exhaustion and start to develop a lot of health issues. And so, and that's, I think that overtraining phenomenon is in that population, they tend to be a lot more vulnerable. So I think that there is definitely more of a risk factor of overtraining by increasing your volume to that extent. So having some short bursts of like HIIT type of training, similar to the Tabata routine, I think is something that would be good to incorporate into training.
Yeah. All right. And what about from a strength standpoint? Is it certain protocols that work best, certain body splits? Or again, it's just going to be very specific to an individual's goal.
Yeah, I think like if you... you know, look at some of the gurus in the strength, like Schoenfeld, for example. I think, you know, there are definitely an optimal number of sets per major body group per week that can lead to these adaptations. Right. And that if you go too far beyond that, it's going to lead to overtraining.
I'm intrigued to ask, from, I hope you don't mind, from a nutrition standpoint, what might a typical day look like for you? Just sort of discussing, you know, you might put in your exercise routine there, but just sort of what a typical day, again, it's going to differ, I'm sure, but what a of eating might look like for you.
Yeah, so I generally, I'll start the night before, okay? I generally try to get to bed between 8:30 and 9.
Mm.
I'm up at about 4:20.
Mm. And there, just on that, what are you just someone who loves waking up early, or what's your reasoning?
Well, so I usually get to the gym just before 5.
Right.
And 4 days a week, I'm doing some strength training for just under an hour.
Mm.
And then say again.
Are you training in a fasted state?
I'm training in a fasted state based on, so, you know, first thing in the morning, I generally have a big dinner the night before that's fairly carbohydrate heavy.
Right.
So when you think about it, in the morning, my glycogen stores are pretty much saturated because I haven't, you know, in my muscles and my liver, I haven't done anything, right?
Mm.
So for a 15-minute strength training workout, I'm pretty good to go.
Right.
And then when I come home, I usually have a fairly protein-heavy type of breakfast with a lot of vegetables and fruit and things like that part of it.
Mm.
And then I'll go to work. So you should get to work by 7. I'm seeing patients, depending on the day, from 7 till 3 or 7 till 6. And then throughout the day, having generally 3 major meals with, you know, I'm aiming for that 1.6, 1.8 grams per kilogram body weight for protein. So I'm just trying to like use that as the main source of my meal. So protein and vegetables are my main throughout the day.
Right.
And then usually get home, have dinner, play with my family, hang out with my family, and then repeat.
Mm. I like it. Very, it simplifies it. With the protein content is, you know, overconsumption of protein, something that we need to be wary of, or is it, you know, very rare that you see this an issue?
I mean, if you look at the RDA for protein is like 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight. And I see that as being very low.
Mm.
The average bodybuilder that I'll see in my practice may be a little bit on the high side. I think like getting up to a gram per pound could be, you know, overdoing it sometimes. You might get too much protein. You're going to displace other essential nutrients potentially. Mm. I think that I don't see a ton that people are overdoing on protein, but more so in different populations. Mm. And most of the time when I'm working with somebody who's trying to build muscle or to lose fat, I try to show them that you need to eat more protein in order to help with that. Mm. And especially if you're going to be in a calorie deficit.
Mm. And is amino acids, when it comes to, you know, bodybuilders and strength training, amino acids and things like creatine have often been talked about. Is this something that you would recommend?
So I think that amino acids from a good quality source protein, like whole food. I like the acronym JERF, Just Eat Real Food.
Mm.
And so I think if you can ideally get your protein from food, great. I think supplementing with whey protein, or if you're a plant-based athlete, then some kind of you know, other complete protein source from a plant source would be fine. I think creatine is a great supplement, very safe. You know, there's, according to the ISSN, over 1,000 studies, and it's something that I use daily.
Mm. There you go. And I know Ben, who I've already spoken about, Ben loves it for things like anxiety and just as a daily supplement. Do you cycle with it, or is it something you, as you just said, you do take on a daily basis?
I think with any supplement, you should cycle it. So I might use it for 2 to 3 weeks regularly and then take a couple of days off, give my body a break a little bit.
Yep. And again, while we're on this, I want to, fat burners in terms of, you know, increasing metabolism, things like this, is this something that it can be beneficial?
I mean, I think the evidence on those things is very low.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, if you want to reference at the end of the podcast to the position stands by the International Olympic Committee and International Society of Sports Nutrition. And then there was a great joint paper that came out that you can get free access to on the American College of Sports Medicine, where a number of associations came together and came up with recommendations. And from when it comes to fat burners, there's, you know, not a ton of evidence behind them. Right. And I think if I were to like give you my some of my top supplements, you know, creatine, whey protein, caffeine, beta alanine, beetroot juice, you know, ashwagandha, these would be things that I, you know, would potentially recommend for my patients. And then depending on whether you're a vegetarian or vegan, additional nutrients to help with some of the things they might be missing from their diet.
Did you say beetroot juice there, was it?
Yeah, beetroot juice.
Is this from, you know, an endurance standpoint, nitric oxide, or what's the reasoning?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. From nitric oxide, and also very good for high blood pressure. I'll put a raw beet in my smoothie every day. You know, I'm big again trying to get it from food.
And what about L-citrulline, which is obviously, you know, typical. I've seen bodybuilders take this for that pump effect. And again, nitric oxide, is this something that has similar effect to the beetroot juice?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, again, been one of the top ones that I've seen recommended through some of the top scientists as, you know, something that's worth spending the extra money on.
Yeah, right. Okay. And do you have a favorite beetroot powder that you go to?
A beet. Real food.
Beet. I like it. There you go. And then I want to touch on just lastly, recovery. How do you personally track recovery with yourself or, you know, your clients, whether it's things like heart rate variability, or does it come back to, you know, just gauging and understanding how your body really feels?
Yeah. I mean, I think that subjectively, that's probably the best way. If somebody has an increase in susceptibility to upper respiratory tract infections, or they have chronic digestive problems, headaches, you know, your body's pretty good at telling you that you're out of homeostasis or out of balance, right? So I do like the idea of the, you know, some of these tools that you can use, like maybe the Oura Ring or something to track heart rate variability. I don't myself use it. I can pretty much, you know, tell if I haven't gotten enough sleep or, you know, invariably for me, my digestion will be off if I'm not getting enough sleep or if I'm overtraining. So, you know, your body's going to tell you, it's just, are you able to listen and recognize that these symptoms are like a warning sign?
And outside of nutrition, because I think we've already covered that quite a bit, is there any recovery protocols that you put in place? Is it, you know, foam rolling, some form of stretching, cold thermogenesis, have we touched on anything like this?
So, I mean, are we talking like injury recovery or recovery from training?
Let's talk about recovery from training to start, and then we might get, we'll start.
I mean, recovery from training, again, I always go back to that pyramid. I mean, there's a big, thing going on right now in sports called REDS, which is relative energy deficiency syndrome in sports, right? So, I mean, if you're not getting enough nutrients to recover, then, you know, it's going to lead to different problems. So, you know, again, getting back to nutrition, it's like basic common sense nutrition. Get enough calories in, replenish your glycogen stores, make sure you have enough protein to facilitate muscle protein synthesis, and get healthy fats to minimize inflammation.
Right. And as I said, outside of nutrition, is there anything that you recommend?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, sleep, stress, you know, I don't think, you know, there's a place that opened up down the street from my practice, and it's they have all these kind of fancy, you know, types of gadgets and IVs and things like that they'll do. You know, something where they're doing something to you passively, and you know, sure, like for example, cold immersion. You know, not a big fan of that because for two reasons. One reason is it. If let's say you're using it as part of your training recovery, okay, your body, when you train, you're stimulating your body through various hormones and chemical messengers to create an adaptation.
Yeah.
And that adaptation, a lot of times, comes from the stress and strain and inflammation that's produced. Mm. If you block that through cold, which is what cold does, then you're potentially blocking these training adaptations. It's counterproductive. Mm. Also, let's say you have an injury and you have some inflammation. Well, is inflammation a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if it's chronic inflammation from an autoimmune disease, that's one thing. Mm. If it's an acute inflammatory response from an injury, your body's saying, I got an injury, I need to heal, I'm going to heal through inflammation.
Yep.
So if you go in there and block the inflammation with some cold or an anti-inflammatory medication, mm. you're not going to heal properly.
Yep. Well, so, where does heat fit into the equation then, say if it is post an exercise session? Is this also going to stop blunt that adaptation? Or I know I've read some research that suggests it might actually release heat shock proteins, which can help with growth hormone, and that is... Have you got a view towards this?
Yeah, I mean, so, okay, so if you have an acute injury where there's some swelling and you want to assist the body, then I would do contrast therapy where you're alternating hot and cold. But heat, in, for the most part, I think heat is really good because it increases circulation.
Yeah. So is this something you post-workout, you know, would suggest is okay?
Yeah, I would say it's okay. I mean, if like for a, like a hot sauna or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm. That would be fine.
Right. And just going back to the cold thermogenesis, so obviously, as you've just said, this is not something you want to do straight after a session or straight after an event, because it is going to blunt that adaptation. Is it something you can do in the later stages, whether it's later on that evening or the following day? Is that going to help with, inflammation at all?
Yeah. I think, like, again, you got to figure out, like, do you want to blunt the inflammation? Mm-hmm. I mean, and my opinion is that you don't. I mean, I prefer meat to rice. So basically meat means mobilized exercise, analgesic and treatment. Mm-hmm. Rice means rest, ice, compression, elevation. And that kind of acronym has been shown to be, counterproductive. Mm-hmm. Other than the compression part, I think that resting an area and icing an area and doing everything you can to stop circulation to that area can potentially prolong the injury. And I've had people get off of my table after they've come in with a limping because they've sprained their ankle, and doing some general mobilization and some massage, get off the table and walk without a limp.
Yeah.
I'm more of like active, stimulate activity. Now, of course, if somebody's got a fracture, then, or like a ligament tear that's unstable, then that's a different story.
Right. What about if it is a soft tissue injury?
So a soft tissue injury, I'm getting in and removing it.
Mm. Regardless, and straight away. So ice is not something you'd recommend, say someone's got a grade one hamstring.
I'm getting in there with my hands. Yep. And then I'll have them do contrast therapy afterwards.
Yeah.
Increase some, fish oil or some turmeric, something like that.
I was going to ask about that when it comes to, say, you've got clients who are injured. How is their, their nutrition and their supplementation? How does this differ? Are you following more, omega-3s and getting inflammation foods, or what might it look like?
Yeah, so I think, the more color you have, the more phytonutrients that are anti-inflammatory. Mm. And I think, like, when it comes to, for example, like antioxidants, getting from food-based sources and not amping up high doses of vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, and zinc, because I think, again, there's some good research that shows that if you are taking these in high amounts, you're blunting your body's ability to either adapt or to heal.
Okay, right.
And now, when you look at something like fish oil, okay. Mm. So, when you look at the inflammatory pathway that occurs through these prostaglandins, okay. So they're pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory eosinoids. So the 2 and 4 series tend to be pro-inflammatory. The 1 and 3 series tend to be anti-inflammatory. Mm. And anti-inflammatory medication like Advil might block the 2 and 4 series, where the fish oil would increase the 1 and 3 series. So I think that it's not so much of a blocking thing when you're taking things like fish oil. It's more like a balancing act.
Mm. And is this something, so with fish oil in particular, would you recommend this on a daily basis?
I think fish oil is a great supplement to support muscle protein synthesis, as well as reducing overall inflammation through balancing your omegas.
And in terms of quantity, what is the overall and recommended dosage?
So if somebody is dealing with an injury, I might go up to several grams, maybe like 3 grams. If for general health, maybe 1 gram.
Okay. And just to finish off, Jeff, I won't take up too much longer. Outside of anything we've covered today, when it comes to sport performance and optimizing, any hacks, is there anything else that, you would recommend or you like to see, whether you do it for yourself or clients, as I said, outside of anything we've covered already?
Yeah, I would say, determine what your goal is and then prioritize your nutrition and your exercise in an evidence-based way around your goal. And there are a lot of good resources out there. Look at the evidence. Don't follow the bro science. Look and see where the scientists are saying this is where we're at. And a lot of times you can see this through position stance through some of these reputable organizations.
Yeah.
And then just, try to, against follow that speed protocol where you are minimizing stressors and optimizing your health.
Jeff, as I said, right at the beginning, you're a big inspiration. You're an absolute wealth of knowledge. So I really appreciate you being a part of this book program.
Thank you. Stay in touch.
Will do.